When you go on holiday, there is no finer achievement than doing absolutely nothing. Nothing on the beach, nothing by the pool. Walking kind of nowhere and chatting about nothing. As an Expedia member, you can save up to 30% when you add a hotel to your flight. So you can have a bit more money to go out there with great ambition to do absolutely nothing. Expedia, made to travel.
Today we have a very special show. I have a guest, David Freiheit, who really has reinvented the concept of a YouTube channel. He talks about law and politics and has a gazillion subscribers and has very, very interesting views, including about my speech on the floor of the United States Senate and about my challenge to YouTube. So here is my interview with David Freiheit. Today on The Dirt Show, we have a remarkable guest, somebody who I admire enormously. I'll give you the full introduction in a second, but just a word of preface. I wrote a book some years ago called Letters to a Young Lawyer. It's an advice book. And the central advice I gave to young lawyers is invent a career that suits your personality, your values, and your priorities. Don't fit into somebody else's niche. Don't accept jobs that somebody else has created because they think you should fill that role. Create a life for yourself. Create something that's different, something that really suits you. And this guy did it to a T. His name is David Freiheit. Means freedom. What a perfect name for a lawyer. And, you know, graduates a great law school in Quebec, works for a distinguished law firm, represents clients, does very well, comes from a family of lawyers. You know, the most obvious and easy thing for him to do is just sit back and practice law the way people have practiced law for generations, probably do very, very, very well at it. Of course, he'd never see his family, he'd never see his friends, because law is a jealous mistress, as Oliver Wendell Holmes once put it. So this guy set out to create a new career. He was there at the beginning when YouTube really first began to create itself as an alternate media and as one of the most important, powerful social media in the world today. And he created a YouTube channel. It started with nature films and some crazy stuff with him doing stunts and tricks. And then what else would it evolve into? A show largely about law and politics. David came to my attention when he did a careful analysis of my speech in front of the United States Senate, which people called bonkers and crazy, and my argument made no sense. And David, as we'll see, started out believing some of those arguments and then saw the speech for himself. And you'll hear what happened, and you can watch it as I watched it on his YouTube channel. So with no further ado, let me introduce a man I've never met, but I now consider a new friend and somebody I've long admired, and I'm a fan, David Freiheit. So, David, welcome to The Dirt Show.
Alan, thank you very much for having me. I say this is a weird feeling. It's sort of surreal in a way because I've only known you from childhood as O.J. Simpson's attorney, you know, one of the world's leading attorneys. More recently, I've only known you through the computer. So it's an amazing thing that we actually get to have this discussion now, given the fact that all I've been doing for the last year, 2 years was analyzing what you said in front of the Senate and the legal arguments, which I found very persuasive, but we'll get into them.
Well, thank you. I look forward to actually meeting you in person. I look forward to meeting anybody in person. Right now, the only interactions we have is interactions like this. It's as close as one can get. So let's get, before we get to the analysis of my Senate speech, what made you decide to do this remarkable thing, and how come you're so incredibly successful at it? And what does it say to other young people who want to try to compete with you in the marketplace of ideas?
Well, first things first, and like I said this to the other lawyer friends that I have on YouTube, there's no real competition because it is it's a niche that is growing, and there's more than enough room for everybody. And it is genuinely one of those things where the rising tide lifts all ships. But, you know, how did it start? I've been a lawyer. You know, I was sworn in 2007, worked at what was at one point the biggest law firm in Canada in terms of number of lawyers. You know, there were expectations that I would just go on to partner because, as one lawyer put it, I had good pedigree. My dad, you know, a lawyer for almost 50 years, senior partner, managed the litigation firm at the litigation department at Steichman Elliott. And so I wasn't trapped. I wasn't forced. I was just in it. But I never liked it for the reasons which I make vocal in my vlogs. It's a cutthroat industry. It's you're always looking over your shoulder industry. It is an industry which most people who have the experience with it ultimately realize is not so much about justice, but about victory. And those are two very different things. And I said, you know, every year I said, if I don't like this next year, I'm going to stop. If I don't like this next year, and you know, it was a rolling timeline and it just kept on rolling. And then I had my first kid. And I said, look, I have to change my lifestyle at least. Maybe I'll like it better on my own. So I left the big firm, thought I was going to go into commercial photography, ended up just getting started on my own and built that into a boutique litigation firm. But, you know, 7 years later, still didn't like it. And in the meantime, discovered YouTube, discovered a passion of mine as a kid, rediscovered video editing, video making. And I started doing that. And then, you know, the marriage Amazing. Just happened. The more I talked about law, the more people got engaged as the subject matter. And
why? You know, why do people get so engaged in the law? Particularly, we live in a very divisive political time. Why the law?
So it's an interesting thing. The first thing is, I don't think people understood, or you know, a lot of people don't truly appreciate what the day in the life of a lawyer is like. There's glamour that they see on LA Law, but it's everyone knows that that's not what it is. But people don't really know what it is. So you know, I started off just did a day in the life of a lawyer. And people liked it. And they said, do more of these. I love seeing behind the scenes what law is about. Then I did another video where I was preparing for a rental board dispute that actually went on for 2 years, if you can believe it.
Yeah.
And you know, preparing case law. Nobody sees it. They think it's glamorous, but they don't appreciate the tedious, you know, paperwork and all the stuff that goes on behind the day in court.
Or what you said, it's not about truth. And it's not about justice, it's about winning. I spent yesterday in a deposition in my own case where I was falsely accused of having sex with somebody I never, ever met. Every single person involved in this case knows I'm innocent. Everybody. You can't not know it. We have our own admissions. We have her best friend on tape. We have her lawyer on tape. All admitting she never met me. And these lawyers are still determined to prove the opposite of what they know to be true, because that's the only way they'll earn their fees. That's the only way they'll get fame. That's the only way they'll get victory. I don't think these lawyers ever stop for 1 minute and say, what's the truth? What's justice here? It is frustrating.
No, it's not. I mean, I know of this. I know of your situation. I've read about it and I saw preparing for this, I was watching some interviews and I saw you on The View. I know the details, but you know, in the broad sense, you know, people don't appreciate depositions are like congressional hearings. They are about getting a snippet of an audio clip that you can then use for your purely, you know, client-based interests, for good or for bad, for truth or for untruth, or for just or for not unjust. And well, you know, you do it, and at some point, I got a little tired of it. It's like, okay, I'm good at it. I can do it. I can break someone down and make them cry in deposition. But then you got to come home, and you got to go to sleep, and you got to wake up, and you got to do it again. And at some point, if you don't feel good about what you're doing, you know, there's only so long you can continue doing it for.
There's this famous exchange between Oliver Wendell Holmes and his law clerk. The law clerk comes in and says, but Mr. Justice, this opinion you've asked me to draft, it's unjust. And Oliver Wendell Holmes turns to him and says, young man, we're not in the justice business. We're in the law business. And, you know, I think if you asked law students in the first year of law school what business they think they're getting into, they'll all tell you they're getting into the justice business. And then they learn it's not about justice. It's about winning. It's about what the law says. And the law can be horribly unjust. And you do an amazing, amazing service by bringing this out to people and making the law interesting and criticism of the law interesting. So a good segue to my Senate argument. That's a perfect example. I'm not a Trump supporter. I'm a liberal Democrat. I would have made exactly the same argument on the floor of the Senate had Hillary Clinton been impeached for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. My argument was a purely constitutional argument. And yet everybody took sides. If I had made the same argument on behalf of Clinton, the very lawyers who called it bonkers and crazy would have praised it. Indeed, they would have made that argument themselves because it's a valid argument. There are two sides to it, obviously. I presented one side of the interesting argument about whether you need crime or criminal type behavior to impeach somebody. And you saw it. You saw it better than anybody else. You said there was an academic consensus the opposite way, and you, like me, bucked the academic consensus. So tell us about how you came to do this video, which I urge everybody to watch on your YouTube channel, in which you decompose and go through my whole speech and argue with parts of it, but agree with other parts of it. How do you come about to do that?
So this is an amazing thing. You know, the channel really took a direction when I started trying to, you know, explain some legal stuff and also trying to explain stuff to myself. I've never been into American law or politics, but seeing, you know, certain things happen with Alex Jones and seeing the impeachment, I was informing myself as much as I was actually, more than I was trying to inform anybody else. So I started, you know, looking into it. What is impeachment? We've heard about it. I lived through Clinton's, but I was, 19 or 20 at the time. So I wasn't politically or legally aware. So, you know, I started looking at what is impeachment? Okay, consensus is, well, it says high crimes and misdemeanors, but the consensus is it can be anything. It's a political remedy and not a judicial one. And so, consensus is a powerful thing. I feel, okay, it's the consensus. Who am I to disagree? I'm some, you know, Montreal schnook in his car talking to a camera. But then I start hearing the other arguments. And I started talking with, you know, Robert Barnes, who I do these live streams with. And I listen to your arguments. And, you know, one says it's a purely political tool. It can be for the color of his socks. And that's the way it is. But then the more I started thinking about it and the more I heard diverging opinions, if it's a political tool, it basically gives the Senate veto power over the electorate, which doesn't make sense and is also not in line with the wording of the provision itself. So that if it doesn't make sense and if it doesn't pass, you know, a basic test of logic and interpretation of statute and interpretation of law, at some point you have to say, okay, I don't care what the consensus is. And incidentally, now seeing how consensus can be absolutely motivated by politics or swayed by politics, I view consensus with a much more cynical eye, but that was the evolution. And I hear you talk about it and I say, look, it requires something of a crime. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been called high crimes and misdemeanors. It would have just been called anything. I don't know how you respond to that. Okay, you can say historically what the consensus was, and that's fine. You have a disagreement. But between the two arguments, and I started off on one side and was convinced by the other argument, I think your line of reasoning just makes more sense. It's in line with intent, it's in line with drafting, and it's logical. Otherwise, the Senate can at a whim decide to overturn the will of the people. And that could not have been what was meant by high crimes and misdemeanors.
I think that's right. And I think the verdict of history will vindicate my argument. But how do you deal with a situation when virtually every American academic, every professor of constitutional law is wrong and you're right? It sounds very arrogant to say that, but, you know, I was brought up as a Jewish, and I know that in the 1800s, every thinking person believed that Jews killed Christian children on Passover and bled them and used their blood in making the matzah for Passover. That was the consensus. Every reasonable person, other than Jews, believe that. You couldn't challenge that. You couldn't challenge the fact that the Jews killed Jesus. You couldn't challenge the fact that the protocols of the elders of Zion showed how Jews set out to control the world. And yet people of Jewish background stood up against the world consensus and proved them wrong. And in my life, at least, it always gave me a sense of, I don't care what the majority says. I do care who they vote for. That's what democracy is all about. But in academia, for 55 years that I was in academia, I never cared about the consensus. I always did my own research, followed my own instincts, and wrote what I believed, and mostly got criticized for it. But I couldn't care less. I gather you have some of the same views, at least now. Is that correct?
I just want to understand, and I just want to be logical and consistent. I think, you know, where you got a lot of flack is that your position in 2019 was diametrically opposed to your previous position, which was the academic consensus. And so you'll be called whatever name.
I fell into the academic consensus. That issue wasn't before anybody in those days because Clinton had committed a crime. We knew that. The question was whether it was a high crime. So that wasn't the issue. And so without doing the research, I said, yeah, I assume that it can be criminal. It doesn't have to be technically a crime. I was just wrong. And when I discovered I was wrong.
Well, and incidentally, you may have been wrong then, you may have been wrong now. The question is, you can attack the person. And I think it's called the Etchukok fallacy, whatever. There's a fallacy about, you know, going after the person. Sometimes it's
ad hominem. The argument ad hominem, right.
Yeah, I don't know, but there's another one about accusing the interlocutor of hypocrisy,
right.
Or...
Right.
So, but either way,
I do that from time to time. I accuse interlocutors of hypocrisy when I can point out that they would make the exact opposite argument if the shoe were on the other foot. Yeah.
Well, there's no question. First of all, it may be true of the person, but it doesn't undermine the argument. So you may be wrong then. You might be wrong now. The only issue is the only thing now to discuss is the argument. Does it not hold water? And the interesting thing is, you know, the religious dogma, religious practices have always been a separate beast, so to speak. What's interesting is, you know, how politics has become a form of religious dogma, where you go from the political affiliation and then get to your conclusions of law and interpretation. And you're right, the same, flip the parties around, and the same lawyers who are blasting you would be praising you, and the same lawyers who are now trying to trash you would be hoisting you up, the same way they do for other scholars who support their position. And that's where, you know, there's been a dogma in politics and there's a dogma in science, and that's how you sort of, you know, destroy the discourse. But I just want to understand the arguments so I can come to my own conclusions. I've heard both arguments, and I've not just heard them, I've listened and I've thoroughly analyzed them from, you know, the far left legal eagle who says it could be the color of socks they can impeach, to you, Robert Barnes, who say it has to be a crime, otherwise high crimes and misdemeanors makes no sense. Otherwise, you don't elect the president. He's tolerated by the Senate. And so I've come to my own conclusion. And I guarantee you, if the rules were reversed and it was a different president, everyone would have had the diametrically opposed positions based only on political affiliation. And it's a sad reality, but it's what happens when you have motivated reasoning, arguing from conclusions and not towards them.
What do you do about that? How do you avoid that? People do just, you're right. The analogy is a perfect one. If you start with, you know, there is one God and he's the God of this Bible or that Bible. And if, you know, you start with a religious conclusion, everything has to follow from that. And if you start with a religious conclusion that everything Trump does is wrong, everything his opponents do is right, any criticism of Trump is legitimate, any attempt to try to defend his rights is illegitimate, and then let's find arguments that support those conclusions. How do you respond, particularly when you have a media that's so divided? I got basically banned from CNN for making arguments that were inconsistent with their narrative. And so I mean, what you did was so brilliant, creating your own YouTube channel. Tell me, how do you go about doing that? And what would you recommend I do? You have, 100 times as many subscribers as I do. I try to put on an interesting show about law. I don't want to compete with you. But as you say, rising tide. What's your recommendation? How do I multiply the number of subscribers I have on my show? If you tell me get younger and get better looking like you, sorry, I can't do that. But other than getting younger and getting better looking, what recommendations would you make?
So from a purely technical recommendation, the funny thing is what looks like overnight successes, you know, take years. And I've only learned to hone a number of skills and to even understand how YouTube works. the YouTube algorithm, or the, you know, people want branded content. So nobody wants to come to a channel if it's fishing one week, cooking the next, a 30-second video versus a 20-minute video, and a law video from time to time. So I really noticed the growth occurred when I just niched down onto law. What I've noticed is people's attention spans are short. That's, and mine is even shorter than most. So, you know, longer format stuff is harder to digest, harder to digest. It's harder to share. So people like shorter content. Reading stuff tends to be boring. And so, you know, I interject my own quips, my own memes, you know, clips just to keep things entertaining from a style perspective. But from a content perspective, people are looking for specific questions to specific answers depending on what's in the news. And so, you know, I read the news, find something that I think I can offer some legal breakdown, legal insight, creative explanation, just to simplify so people can understand, and just go for that. And that's been working. You know, I'm fighting a sort of a battle with YouTube. I think in a sense that I'm definitely not as promoted as people who sort of, I would say, maybe toe the narrative the way YouTube wants. So it's sort of an uphill struggle, but struggle builds character. And that's it, you know, just pick a subject. Yesterday was the breaking news in McCloskey's. So quick video, explain what's going on.
I guess you would probably advise me, however, that it's not the best way to get YouTube viewers when early on in your career, you challenge YouTube to take down your channel, as I have done, because I very directly and explicitly violated one of their rules when they announced that they would not allow anything on their channels or anything, any videos on YouTube that question whether the election may have been influenced by fraud or mistake. I purposely had Joel Pollack on the show. He said that. I then challenged YouTube to take down that episode. They haven't done that, but I doubt that I've made too many friends at YouTube over that challenge.
I've had my, you know, my issues with YouTube in that they randomly demonetize videos, they remove comments, which people then attribute as my actions, and they accuse me of censoring comments, which I don't. They retroactively demonetize. YouTube does all sorts of things because it's a scaling up issue where, you know, they plug in words of the day as to what's the naughty word of the day. If it's Hunter Biden's computer, if it's Texas election fraud, they put it in an algorithm. It just goes and zaps videos. So part of it is scaling up. But yeah, part of it is you go in, and if you make enemies, you're not going to get recommended quite as much, but you might. I say from a policy decision, I still haven't gotten over how YouTube even thought that that was a good idea, a tenable idea, one that is not going to result in a Streisand effect of sorts, to come in and say, it's not a question of terms of service anymore, doxing, violence, violent content, offensive content, nudity. Now we're saying a subject, which is a sort of an innocuous subject to speak of, is a no-no on the platform. I don't know how they thought that would go over well or at all. So I'd be curious to see if they're actually going to implement it or impose it. I think they just want to get some of the most extreme, for lack of a better word, promoters of election fraud off the platform, or find ways to soft censor them, to disincentivize them to cover the subject. But, you know, my personal feeling is whenever anybody starts censoring something, typically it's not because of how idiotic the ideas are. It's for other reasons, which can vary, you know, circumstances depending.
So I'm now going to promote you, or demote you, as the case may be. You're now the CEO of YouTube. You've just gotten this new job because you've been so successful. And I'm the CEO of Google. So we have our little meeting. And I said, look, we can't allow anything. We can't allow anything on our platform. On the other hand, we want exemption under Section 230 as a platform. We have to censor some things. For example, we have to censor child pornography. We have no question about that. It would be illegal for us to put child pornography on. And now we've been asked to censor Holocaust denial, which is false, clearly false, demonstrably false, but tens of thousands of people believe in it. So, Mr. New CEO of Google, how would you deal with Holocaust denial on YouTube?
So, this is a question that's not only going to promote or demote me, but get me into hot water. My philosophy is, I studied philosophy, actually, as a perfect segue. And in McGill, when I studied philosophy, I read Chomsky. And at the time, I remember Chomsky had written a foreword for a book, which was, I think at the time, considered to be a Holocaust denial book. He wrote the
Robert foreword. Robert Farrison's book. I know. I critiqued his writing the foreword. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Go ahead.
I forgot the names because this is 20 years old and it meant something different to me then than now. And at the time, I remember thinking, Chomsky, how dare you? This is terrible. Now that I've lived another 20 years since and seen the way it goes from censoring illegal content to censoring politically sensitive content to censoring politically convenient content, you know, I tend to think, let people discuss their ideas to the extent that they are not specifically targeting any identifiable or, you know, broad group for any acts of violence. You know, some people are going to argue that any form of Holocaust denial, whatever they take that word to mean, is going to be an act of violence. You know, discussion.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. But let me tell you where I disagree with you. I feel very Chomsky was a friend of mine. I knew him. We worked together against the Vietnam War. He was my camp counselor. In Hebrew-speaking Camp Masad in 1948, the year Israel was established as a state. He was the head of the division that I was in. And I defend him and I support him when he defends the right of Holocaust deniers to write books. I defend that right as well. But I would never dream of writing an introduction to a book of Holocaust denial, because that seems to me to be putting the imprimatur on the content of the book. It's like the difference between defending the Nazis marching through Skokie, which I do, and joining the demonstration and being in the Nazi group holding a flag with a swastika. I think that's what Chomsky did when he wrote an introduction that helped promote and sell the book. What he should have done is written an essay saying this is a despicable, horrible book. Nobody should read it, but it should be out there in the marketplace of ideas. If you want to read it, read it. But I'm not defending it or supporting it. Why do you think it was the right thing for him to write an introduction?
No, I don't think it was the right thing. I just think that, you know, I don't think it was the right thing, and there's no but, actually. I sort of think you're more in line in what he could have done or should have done. I just say I view it a little differently now, where seeing the way it goes, first of all, I would never have done it myself, period. I would support people having whatever discussions they want, because I think in having that discussion, you will never convince some, but you'll never convince those people by censoring them in any event. You're only going to actually reaffirm their beliefs. I do think sunlight is the greatest disinfectant, but I wouldn't have done it. I just view it a little bit differently today, seeing the way things go, is that if you go now from, since, you know, taking that subject in particular, but then historical events, where does it stop there? And then, strictly speaking, when does YouTube cease being a platform where even unpopular ideas can be discussed?
Well, I think that's the key.
Because
I think that's the key question.
And I just, go ahead. to be clear, like I'm not. It's not that I'm defending Chomsky for having written the foreword. I just view it differently now. At the time, I say, like, you know, there are certain things that you don't tolerate. Period. And as a kid, you say, like, yeah, don't let them express their ideas, as though that solves the problem. The reality is that express their ideas doesn't solve the problem. It actually just makes it worse for the most part. And, you know,
To put it in the context of law, which we both are involved in, I was asked to represent a neo-Nazi some years ago. And here's what I said to him. I will be your lawyer from 9 to 5 in the courtroom. I will defend your right. He was a law student who took the bar, passed the bar, and was denied admission to the bar because he was a Nazi. And he asked me to defend his right to be a member of the bar, which I defended. I said, from 9 to 5, I will defend your right in the courtroom. But 5 o'clock, I will get out and call you the most despicable names, the worst Nazi, the worst, and hope that on the way home you're hit by a bus. Because that wouldn't be the government doing this. That would be somebody else doing this. But I will not defend the right of the government, state government, bar, or anybody else, to deny you the right to practice law because of your views. But I will spend as much time attacking you outside the courtroom. And he said that was okay. The reason I ended up not representing him is I said to him, I know you don't have a lot of money now, but I want you to agree to pay me a fee, my usual fee, when you have the money, and I will donate that money to the Anti-Defamation League, the NAACP, and all the organizations you despise. And he said, no, he couldn't agree to that. So I ended up not being his lawyer, and the Supreme Court affirmed his disbarment. I don't know that I would have won the case had I continued to be his lawyer, but that's the attitude and approach I take to speech that I fundamentally disagree with. So to unless you have, do you have anything to say about that, or else I wanted to move to a related subject.
Okay. I would just say, I don't think I would even, as a lawyer, I didn't take files that I didn't, not only that I could deal with the subject matter, but that I could deal with the individual. So, and that might have, you know, limited the files that I took, because I would never.
That would mean I couldn't defend anybody. When you think of the people I've defended, if I have to like the individual, forget about it.
And that's, it saved me some headache, and it probably lost me. I probably left some career money on the table, but I took files. It was even better when I went out on my own, because overhead was lower and I could really select files that I liked. And clients that I liked. I do have so I would have never taken the file in the first place, but I do tend to agree. Like, you know, I let the comments in my comment section go. I don't care. People call me all sorts of names. I don't delete the comments. Because I like you have to let people discuss. And if you don't, you're really making the problem worse. And people don't fully.
I agree with that. I completely agree with that. So let me get you into even more trouble. Where do you stand on whether or not YouTube today should get Section 230 exemption? Let me just explain to the viewers, and I'm sure most of you know. Section 230 provides that a platform, YouTube, Facebook, any of those platforms, Twitter, can't be sued as the result of the content that is on their platform. You can sue the person who puts the content on, but you can't sue the platform. Now people are saying, including me, that when the platform becomes a publisher like the New York Times and begins to decide what is truth and what is not truth, what it will have on and what it won't have on, what it will flag, what it won't flag, what it will call false, what it will call true, it loses its exemption under Section 230. Where do you stand on that?
So I totally agree. I don't think it loses its exemption. I just think the law needs to be read the way it was drafted in the historical context in which it was drafted. And I did a video recently on it. It was Clarence Thomas's, I think it was a 10-page judgment in denying a writ of certiorari in a separate case. He said, we're not taking up the 230 discussion here. It would have been contextually inappropriate anyhow, because I think they were denied immunity. But he said, this is the history of Section 230. It was never intended to give protection for exercising editorial discretion. It was only intended to give protection so that platforms that tried to moderate content so that they didn't host illegal content would not be, you know, liable if they inadvertently did. And this goes back to those two decisions, CompuServe and I'm going to forget the other one. But one of them, I forget the name. One of them was let off the hook because they didn't try to moderate or remove any illegal content from their platform, whereas the other one was held on the hook because they did. And so they came up with this immunity that says, if you try to moderate to remove illegal content, you will not be held liable if you inadvertently don't. But now they've taken it from one step to the next, and the courts have sanctioned it. Says, yeah, you all have blanket immunity. You can do whatever you want if you call yourself a platform. And now that we've gotten into the realm where YouTube is curating its content as much as the editorial board of the New York Times. And I don't say that the law should be rewritten, although I jokingly say abolish the immunity. The law should just be applied normally. And given the indication of what Justice Thomas said in his most recent non-decision of a decision, they just need the right case. And this one could be the right case. There's no question YouTube should not be allowed to do this with impunity, because this is not removing illegal content, lascivious, I forget what the other words are. This is curating for political purposes and intellectual manipulation.
Well, the argument that I make, I wonder what you think about this, is a kind of the negative pregnant argument. That is, when YouTube says that it is a lie and false, and we're going to take it down if anybody says the election would have been different but for fraud and mistake. That's a lie. And then they allow somebody to put on YouTube or on Facebook or on Twitter, Alan Dershowitz is a pedophile. Then it suggests to the viewer that they've made a decision that Alan Dershowitz is a pedophile. And that's true. And they're not going to take that down. I don't know whether YouTube would allow that to go up or take it down. I know Twitter does. Every third tweet under my name says that, despite the overwhelming evidence, indisputable evidence to the contrary. So it's that when you say something is a lie, you're implicitly validating things you didn't take down as the truth, and that creates a terrible impression and a false impression as to what it is you're doing. YouTube would come back and say, no, we're not vetting everything. So we're not saying anything is true. We just have certain words in our algorithm. How would you deal with that argument?
That is the risk that they run by making a decision to curate the content. And I made the joke on Twitter, basically every tweet coming out of Trump is, you know, it says this is a disputed tweet, whatever. So I made the joke now, every time that he makes a tweet that references the election and it doesn't get flagged, I say, oh, this must be double super duper true because Twitter didn't flag it. That's the problem. What happens? That's how you make a bigger mess, by trying to pinpoint and selectively curate content. I don't care if something, my bottom line, I don't care if it's a lie. It's the internet. You can lie. And the only way to expose a lie is to counter the lie, not to censor the lie. And since when did Section 230 immunity cover lies on the internet? Because then there's no end to what they're going to do. And it just gets into that, that dictatorial method of governing where you pick your lie that you want to go after, or you make a law so broad that it applies to everybody and nobody so that you can use it against anybody who you selectively want. And that's what YouTube is doing. Lies are not illegal. And there's no reason why YouTube should be removing lies, even if they are, in fact, bona fide lies, in my humble opinion.
So one final question, and the reason it's a final question is I'd love to keep you on for 6 or 7 hours and continue this discussion. But I recently got advice from a very wise man saying if you want to be successful on YouTube, keep the video short. People don't like long, long videos. So we are both victims of your advice. So my final question, I think you'll agree with me, that social media, YouTube, raises the great freedom of speech questions of the 21st century. And as both of us who support freedom of speech in the marketplace of ideas, in my case, the First Amendment, in your case, the Canadian Bill of Rights, or whatever it's called in Canada, helped drafted by our friend Erwin Kotler. In any event, how do you think over the next years the social media will impact life in Canada and the United States? And what do you think the future of the social media and censorship is? A broad question, but just give me a relatively brief answer.
I mean, I've made my prediction to friends. First of all, we have rights in Canada, but they're worth no more than the paper they're written on when the government doesn't uphold them. And so we have our government coming in and saying it wants to regulate the internet. It wants to charge fees to news-based platforms, make them register. Once you start forcing people to register with the government, you have a limit. You have a slippery slope that we've seen where it goes, and it goes there inevitably. I think, unfortunately, there is going to be more political censorship on Twitter, on YouTube, my prediction is ultimately YouTube is going to turn itself into television. It's going to be only for the big names. It's only going to be for advertiser-based, Fox News, CNN, people who don't care about having their content demonetized. And rivals are going to come up. What I think is also going to happen as rivals come up, big tech and politics are going to go after them and try to get them stifled and shut down. But we'll see. I mean, I've seen it happen time and time again. But there will be rivals. There may be a righting of the ship, so to speak. Maybe they're going to realize that they're pushing off creators who are making them lots of money and made the platform what it is. Maybe there's going to be an amazing lawsuit that's going to go after YouTube for false business representations. The creators built YouTube into what it is. And now YouTube is basically saying everything we told you to build your homes here was a lie. And you basically built your house on sand, although most of us, appreciate that we have. But I think the censorship is going to get worse, especially under a presidency that is aligned with big tech. People worry about government censorship. That's easier to fight against in the sense that you can vote. It's big tech censorship when it's aligned with the government that is the most powerful thing, because you have big tech running interference and running the agenda for an elected government. But hopefully I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. Keep making these points. I will keep making these points on the Durr Show. I have to end just by saying I have so much admiration for you, not only for the substance of your views, but what you went about doing. You really just fulfilled what the advice I gave young people. You created yourself. You created a new genre for lawyer, YouTube, And you've used the new technology in a way that is so creative and interesting that I have no end of admiration for you. One day I'd love to be on your show. I hope to invite you back on my show. Let's keep freedom of speech alive together. Let's keep dialogue going, and let's together and separately continue to search for truth and logic and reasonable arguments. So, David, thank you so much for sharing your insights on the DERF Show.
Thank you for having me, Alan. It was great to meet you.
And please call me with questions and comments and criticisms that you have of me and the show. The number is 216-710-0050. 216-710-0050. Call me. I really want to hear what you have to say. You provide the wits that completes the DERF Show Wits.